our presentation today is translating research and disaster preparation emergency response for people with disabilities into policy and practice. We think there's, as you'll see later on today, that there is starting to be a body of literature in this area. The question is, what do we do with it? And it's kind of keeping with the theme of this whole conference for APHA this year. Acknowledge my co-presenters, Tony Cahill, Kathy Rooney, Mike Fox, not here, and Dr. Elizabeth Gleckler, you in the back of the room, I think? Dr. Gleckler, yep. She participated in some of the work we did with Katrina that Tony will be summarizing today. The purpose of the session will really be two different parts. The first, the presenters will summarize current research literature, identify recommendations for policy and practice, and then we will have some panel reactants that will be involved in helping us to think about knowledge translation to implement these recommendations, looking at perhaps maybe barriers that we might encounter, challenges, perhaps opportunities as well. What I'd like to do next is start with a just kind of a conceptualization of how we see this session and the process we're going to be doing hanging together. A little bit of a busy slide, but I'll start over on the y-axis. You'll note that we're looking at, when we think about issues concerning people with disabilities dealing with disaster preparation emergency response, looking at the individual, organizational, community level. At the top of the screen, you'll see that we're looking at issues concerning knowledge mining. Now, that's information that's already out there. Knowledge creation, research is created to help to learn more about what we need to find out about disaster preparation emergency response. Then how do we go about translating that knowledge? The bottom of the screen, we see a lot of the knowledge mining really taking place during pre-investigation time. Research, obviously investigation, then thinking about the dissemination process. And you'll be seeing this as we progress through the same slide, but it'll be a little bit some different changes on it. Knowledge mining, a little bit about that. We talk about literature reviews, on preparedness, looking at best practices that are available there. At the organizational level, there's a lot of emergency management policies and practices out there. Some are good, some are not so good. What do we learn from the both examples and non-examples? Community, reviewing community policies and practices. Research is obvious. Thinking about knowledge translation, these are just some exemplars. I'm certainly sit around and generate a much more complete list, but as exemplars of that, state of the science conferences, peer-reviewed publications, plethora of resources on the internet, training dissemination, clearinghouses, social marketing and risk assessment, among others. And then taking these and really pushing them into the policy and practice. What I'd like to do next is turn the mic over to Dr. Tony Cahill, University of New Mexico. He's going to talk a little bit more about a review of the literature and what do we learn from it. So, do you want to come over here?
Maybe? Yeah,
that'd be best.
Thanks, Glenn. You know, there are relatively few advantages to kind of approaching senior part of life. There is one advantage, however, which is that things begin to recycle. And it's, you know, in the old version of, you know, for example, at one point, Glenn's tie is going to become fashionable again. You know? But one of the things in a more serious note, the concept of knowledge translation, and I suspect many of you in your institutions, whether they be government institutions or academic institutions, have begun to come across and start talking about knowledge translation. And the great thing about this is that it's not new. My first job, actually, in the 70s was as the assistant director of the Center for Knowledge Utilization and Planned Social Change at the University of Pittsburgh. And I was also the managing editor of a journal with the snappy title of Knowledge, Creation, Diffusion, Utilization. It was a wonderful cure for insomnia. But the core concept is in emergency preparedness now in people with disabilities, one of the propositions that we're putting forth, and it's not original, of course, to us, is that we're at a point at which, in terms of this schematic here, clearly there is more research to be done. But that we're at a point where we can begin to take the results of a fairly significant body of research that's been done across many kinds of disasters, across many kinds of disabilities, and begin to apply some of the lessons learned. So the questions turn to not what we know, but what do we know and how well do we know it? And that second question is a very important question. Do we know something well enough to begin to act on it? And my part of this presentation for the next 10 minutes or so is to just try in a very brief way to summarize the body of research that has emerged, which actually goes back before 9/11 and before Katrina. Those are the events we pay a lot of attention to. But this is not a new field. It's gotten an awful lot more attention since. Now, I'm going to breeze through an awful lot of stuff. I assume that everybody, we have plenty of copies of the presentation that are lurking out there in the audience. No one leaves the room until they're all gone. And in terms of URLs for these research studies, they're all listed on the presentation. So there's no need to try to copy everything down and run very quickly. The next 11 slides, really, I'm going to go through it incredibly quickly. I want to demonstrate one key point, that from the federal government, from state governments, from disability organizations, we have a fairly significant body of research. And I'm not going to summarize everyone. I've given just some very quick exemplars. And really what I'm talking about here is looking at both from kind of knowledge mining or data mining and knowledge creation, that is primary research that's been undertaken. What do we know at this point about the impact of disasters on people with a wide range of disabilities, and exactly how well do we know it? Now, we've got an awful lot of assessments by federal agencies. This is one which I'm sure you're all familiar with, the Nationwide Plan Review, done by the Department of Homeland Security and Transportation. The federal government would not call this research necessarily, but it is. In terms of the process they use to create it, in terms of the quality of the findings, the rigor of the assessment, this is a review of all 50 state emergency operations plans, which included a self-assessment by the states, site visits by a team of federal folks. The report is well worth reading. Just under half of all the recommendations they made in this report have to do with disability. And they identified this as one of the major gaps. Certainly, the Senate Committee on Homeland Security filed a report, again with the title, A Nation Still Unprepared. But there are lots and lots of others. The 2005 House study, the Failure Initiative report that the House of Representatives did, the DHHS, Health and Human Services Inspector General, did a superb report on nursing homes in Katrina. Superb in the sense that the findings were heartbreaking and terrible, but the quality of the work was superb. Certainly, the LLIS.gov, Lessons Learned Information Sharing, is a wealth of information from research studies. If you're not familiar with that, it is literally LLIS.gov, which is a wonderful website in which people upload lessons learned from a wide range of local and state-level communities. There have been, surprisingly, this one came up first. I cannot imagine why. It must be random. A number of university assessments have been done. This, of course, being the study that Glenn's shop did of Hurricane Katrina, in which we looked at the experiences and the communications and interactions between the disability community organizations and the emergency management community. I hate it when APH Day does not pay the light bill. I hate that. With the money we pay to come to this conference. Certainly Nobody Left Behind, which I think almost all of you are familiar with, and if you aren't, you should be. A study of some 30 disasters across the country in terms of people with mobility limitations. There is, at the moment, as we speak, another conference going on here in Washington at the Cosmos Club. The University of Maryland Center for Health and Homeland Security, with funding from the Tribune McCormick Foundation, is hosting a 2-day conference at the Cosmo Club on what they're calling vulnerable populations. And I would say, if any of you are looking for what is a really good summary of research, hit this website. They've done I can't speak to the outcome of the conference, particularly since I'm not there and it's not done. But in looking at the website, they have really done a very nice job of summarizing research findings. Disability organizations. The California State Independent Living Council did a very good report on the California wildfires. And Mike Collins, who's in the back of the room, may have had something to do with that. The National Council on Disability has done a very good study, the impact of Katrina and Rita on people with disabilities, remaining challenges. But there are lots of others. The AARP in 2005 did a report called We Can Do Better. The Canadian Transport Policy did a very good evacuation study in 2006 of Katrina and Rita. And then the other NCD report, Saving Lives. Now, I didn't, as you notice, summarize those studies because that would not only be incredibly long but incredibly boring. What I'd like to try to do is to take a look at some cross-cutting results of all this research and suggest what is it we do know, how well do we know it, and what the gaps are based on this rather extensive body of research. And the ones I gave as examples just now really only touch the surface of the extent of the research that's been done. Clearly, they're of varying quality. Some are superb, rigorous, methodologically rigorous. Some aren't. But so while they are of varying quality, together they present us with a fairly extensive body of research about what went right, what's gone wrong, and what we can do to improve. And here's the link then to in translational research. The task at this point is to convert what we know into what to do about what matters. Matters of importance that affect people with disabilities. So let me see if I can, in just a few pithy slides here, briefly summarize some of this research. In terms of pre-disaster planning, this has become a chestnut, but it is still true for being a chestnut. There is almost no personal preparedness planning by people with disabilities. We find this again and again in study after study, that people with disabilities do not prepare ahead of time. There is also too little organizational disaster planning by agencies providing services to disabilities. And just to give you one very quick example, in the study that we did in Katrina, of the independent living centers we looked at, only one said they had any kind of a plan to look after organizational assets if a disaster should occur. And that plan wasn't written. They'd talked about it at a staff meeting. I don't know if any of you had a chance yesterday, there were the student assembly ran a poster session yesterday. Roberta Carlin and I went by and looked. Some very good papers by students. One of them talked about this very topic in terms of healthcare facilities. And again, the conclusion is the same. Organizations don't prepare either for disasters. And emergency management agencies, and again, this is a chestnut, but it's true for being a chestnut, still engage in far too little planning for the needs of this population by emergency management, by the agencies themselves. Part of the problem here is not an unwillingness by emergency managers to plan. It's, to be very candid, a tower of Babel between the disability community and emergency management agencies. One of the things that a surprising number of disability organizations are not aware of is that emergency managers at the state and local level tend to be very, very flexible before an event occurs. They would like to talk to folks. They would like to have people with disabilities involved in the planning. Once the event occurs, these very flexible folks become very rigid, command and control oriented people, because that's what emergency response is in the response phase of a disaster. It's based on a military command and control system. And this lack of communication between the two means to some great extent that they are just not, they are not able to incorporate the plans when they need to. There are too few plans at all levels to keep healthcare facilities functioning in large-scale disasters. There was a very good session actually in the room right next door at 2:30, which was did not have to do with disability, but it was three papers on healthcare facilities in Katrina and Rita. And it was quite good, but the bottom line of that those sessions next door mirrors what we know about people with disabilities, that healthcare facilities have a difficult time functioning, and very few of them have any plans in place to incorporate the needs of people with disabilities while they are in the facility, and certainly if the facility has to be evacuated. And very few plans on the state and local level include effective strategies to coordinate and manage volunteer efforts in every phase of disaster. One of the things we know about disasters is that individuals self-deploy. And I don't mean just first responders, but that includes first responders. They decide to take action, and they do it. Now, this can be very good. It's a great example of volunteerism, of people rising to the occasion, of neighbor helping neighbor. So there's a very good part to this. The problem is it's uncoordinated. And an uncoordinated response can be ineffective. The National Plan Review made three very important points, which include but go beyond disability, and I want to just briefly mention them. The plans they're referring to here are state emergency operation plans. The majority of state plans cannot manage catastrophic events. Both plans and exercises are scaled to familiar events. One of the largest critiques by the Department of Homeland Security and Transportation was that we plan for the last disaster, that we tend not to think about what could happen in our communities or in our states that hasn't happened. I don't know if any of you saw the news this morning, CNN, early in the hotel. I believe it was Bolivia this morning, had a hailstorm which produced, and I saw it with my own eyes, so it had to be true on TV, over 8 feet of hail. Cars were inundated, not by snow, not by rain, by hail. Of course, it melted, it became rain, or it became water. And the overriding message of the report was, this is unprecedented. Nothing like this has ever happened before. In the same way, the critique of the plans in the states is that they are scaled to what we already know, and therefore are going to be of relatively little use when something we didn't think of happens. And the phrase at the bottom, think the unthinkable, which is actually an old phrase of Herman Kahn's, means that we need to think about things and prepare for things that have not yet happened and that we find, frankly, inconceivable. What do we know about pre-disaster information and communication? Well, this body of research that I referenced before and the much larger body of research which it stands for, there is little or no communication between local emergency management agencies and people with disabilities. And there's little or no communication between local disability organizations and emergency management agencies on either level before a disaster. There are too few risk communications or community education campaigns that are targeted at people with disabilities. This is not to say they don't exist. Some do. And there are some actually very good models out there. But they are frequently unused. In terms of response, what this body of research has told us is that most initial search and rescue is carried out not by the official emergency management community, but by citizen survivors. This would be you and me in our neighborhoods when something happens. or our apartment buildings or our ranches or whatever. People in a disaster, at first, in the immediate aftermath of an event, they turn to other people who are members of communities of interest. What do I mean by community of interest? It can be your neighbor, but it can also be a member of your church. Faith-based organizations are critically important in this. The animal organizations, the lions and the elks and the moose and the tigers and the bears and the rattlesnakes and the iguanas and so on. These are the neighborhood associations. These are the people to which other people turn in a disaster. And people come to shelters and evacuation points or hospitals by private means. They bypass official systems. This is so critical because, as you may know, all of disaster planning, with the exception of pandemic influenza, which we'll kind of park on the side here, is based on the premise of moving people from somewhere to somewhere else. That sounds simple, but if they're moving people from a home, a nursing home, a congregate home, an institution, to somewhere else, a hospital, a point of dispensing site, an evacuation, a general care shelter. All of emergency planning is based on moving people through the official system to somewhere else. But yet we know from research that people just frankly do what they'd like to do, and they go where they'd like to go for the most part. So this presents a terrible conundrum for us. The bottom line, and this is a much hackneyed phrase, but it's very, very true, and it is the phrase on which explicitly federal policy is now built around disaster preparedness, both for people with disabilities and people with not, is all response is local. And now you're going to see why I went into academe instead of becoming a graphic artist. This is a disaster. It can be a fire, it can be a flood, it can be the California fires that just occurred or those of earlier in the decade. It can be the World Trade Center. It can be 8 feet of hail in a major city in South America. In Albuquerque, which is high desert at about 6,000 feet, it always snows in Albuquerque in the winter, but the snow's always gone within 12 to 24 hours. Last winter, we had two back-to-back storms, each of which dumped up to 3 feet of snow on the city, and it didn't go away. And the city was paralyzed. That little circle there, believe it or not, is any of those disasters. Now, depending on the nature of the disaster, the extent of it, at some point, the emergency management system will come into play, and that circle represents the very first local first response. These are county sheriffs. These are our firefighters. These are EMTs. But they're very local. They're within the jurisdiction in which it happens. If the disaster is big enough, at some point, additional resources will be called in. These can be county. Some states have intercounty compacts, so it may be surrounding counties. Some states don't. If the disaster is big enough, again, the state will typically become involved through the provision of state resources. And if the disaster, again, becomes big enough, at some point, the federal government will get involved in deploying assets. The question is, when we say all response is local, is what happens between the event happening and the time the official emergency management response begins? It's the distance from the donut to the first circle. All response is local. All response has to be organized on a community level for it to be effective. I should say, by the way, that taking away these circles is also a good indication of the emergency management system, because all of these levels are meant to go away. That is, these are short-term responses, and you know, they are all meant to disappear. Very quickly, one of the great things that we've learned from research is one of the things that every emergency management jurisdiction tries to do is find a way to identify and locate people with disabilities. The infamous R word, the registry. The road of emergency management is littered with the bodies of failed registries. And we know a fair amount about why that is. Rather than, these are kind of like the seven deadly sins of registries, you know. I mean, if you want to create a really bad registry, here are some tips and techniques for you. But most registries have failed, and they've failed for this reason, or these reasons. They give insufficient attention to what information is needed. They try to be very comprehensive. They don't think about who will use the information and when. And they tend to be very overly complex. And they rely on technology. What's the first thing that doesn't work? Your cell phone. They don't take into account these networks, and they often don't incorporate registries of resources like durable medical equipment, oxygen, and other things. At this point, I'd like to turn it over to my colleague Kat, who's going to talk about some of the conclusions and recommendations from the research.
My job is to take those lessons learned and move them into knowledge translation and then to policy and practice. But I'm only going to take a few minutes, so we're not going to get too specific here. But I just take this up. Yeah, okay. We'll go back to this chart. With knowledge mining, like with literature review, knowledge creation, we come up with recommendations. With knowledge mining, we might find gaps, and we might find things that we know, and we can move right into policy and practice. We can also, under knowledge mining, become a resource for understanding where research should be directed. And with research, we can also go into recommendations. So this is pretty logical here. With knowledge translations, the state of the science, conferences, peer review publications, internet resources, again, not the internet resources, but the other two can create recommendations and go right into policy and practice. And so that's kind of where we are. I'm on the third column. And the tools for taking this knowledge and moving it into policy and practice actually is knowledge translation. So what I'd like to do before I go on is give you a little background. Many of our observations that we've given you today in the summary of research and what I'm going to talk about are fairly well known now, and they don't come to much of a surprise for most of you in the audience. However, there still remains unmet needs, and just because these items are very well known doesn't make them less important. So we've got out there several excellent reports that were assessments and came out and made wonderful recommendations and wanting to move this knowledge into policy and practice. And so I had, again, like Tony, I had many examples I could go to, but I picked one of my very favorite that I helped organize in 2005, where we brought together 30 individuals that were experts in the disability field, emergency management, and the healthcare. And this group of individuals came up with recommendations and action plans in these categories. So these are the ones I'll talk about. Education and training, increase involvement of persons with disabilities in emergency management, clearinghouse information, and future research. Now, in this area of personal and organizational preparedness planning, when we started with the Nobody Left Behind research in 2003, my task was to go find out all that information for personal preparedness and business preparedness. And there were only a few pamphlets at that time that were geared for disabilities. And they were probably American Red Cross and National Fire Protection Association. There were some other ones, but those were the two major ones. In the last couple of years, we've just got all kinds of really good information. We can go further with this information, but now it's kind of like coming out of the woodwork. You have a pamphlet for almost all kinds of organizations. We have Homeland Security, We have National Organization on Disabilities, Red Cross has updated all their information, and so we have a wealth of pamphlets to hand out. But how does that translate into policy and practice? And what structures and mechanisms are there to disseminate and utilize this information? For our hometown, Lawrence, Kansas, when I called our Red Cross to see about those wonderful pamphlets the Red Cross makes, and I like one of their pamphlets a lot with how to go about and get an emergency kit. When I called her to see if I could get them, she said, "Wow, yeah, they're on our list, but nobody ever requests them, so we don't have them ready at hand. So it'll take us a couple of weeks to get them." So again, they're not being disseminated and utilized necessarily. And what principles of social marketing and incentives can be used in this area? Now, in the area of community planning, it's a little bit different story. And as you've heard from Tony again, I'll be kind of repeating a little bit here. There are too few programs developed to help communities increase their capacity to respond to persons with disabilities. You hear about having your church get involved or different organizations, but we really haven't seen a lot of models yet. Again, as Tony noted, all response is local, which means communities are first line of defense. We don't have enough practices and policies and programs to help with this task. And so additional knowledge mining and or creation may be needed. Inclusions of persons with disabilities is a cornerstone of the disability movement, as well as research has stated as well when they noted like the Nobody Left Behind program, when only 20% of, well actually in that, 20% had plans for persons with disabilities, but actually no one in our group had consulted with a person with a disability except for the Department of Aging, which they have some overlaps, but it's sort of a different field altogether. So it was pretty appalling findings. Then the federal policies also now state with the Homeland Security Reauthorization Act that persons with disabilities must be actively involved in every phase of the planning process. Well, that's just great, and we've heard it over and over, but how do we go about and do this? Doesn't happen often enough, and it doesn't, and how should we have this happen? With information, again, like we've noted, there's some extensive informational resources. Doesn't mean that we don't need more and we can go in other creative areas, but they do exist. We have several different organizations that have been trying to so-called kind of clearinghouse or have good examples of gathering information. Tony mentioned Lessons Learned Information Sharing, LLIS.gov. There's also the Colorado University also has the Observer, or the National Hazard Observer, also is a great clearinghouse, and also the annotated bibliography from the American Association of Health and Disabilities. But probably, as you all notice lately, ever since Katrina, there's just a flood of information coming at us from all angles, and where do people deposit that information? It'll be with their national organizations or with whatever groups in their health, in their field. Maybe it's in a health field, maybe it's in a disability field, maybe it's an emergency management field. For us, we've been putting ours in disability field, but there's not much crossover into emergency management. So with that, more attention needs to be given to additional clearinghouse activities. And this picture I took about 2 weeks ago in Greensburg, Kansas. And as you all might remember, this spring they had a massive tornado go through, and it wiped out the whole community. I had seen the after effects of Hurricane Katrina, and so when I was driving to this site, which is in the middle of nowhere in Kansas, Dorothy didn't even go there. It's 2.5 hours from anywhere. Anyway, as I was driving there, my stomach started getting knots because I realized I'm going into Katrina situation. This is, you know, my heart just felt for everyone just going there. And sure enough, it was an incredible sight to see. It was just basically trees that had been cut off about, you know, halfway down, and they had green little sprouts. And there was no community, and there was a little bit of debris left, a couple of houses standing, and very little movement towards building new homes. And it had a very active FEMA trailer park. What I learned when I started to talk to individuals, like what you're seeing here on this slide, It's their emergency room, and so it looks like a MASH unit for their Kiowa County Memorial Hospital. So that came up pretty quickly. So that's a policy and practice that has been established long-term, and it's an effective way to move people up, and they know how to do that. But what we also noticed was immediately the community must have learned from Katrina. They immediately kept their high school. It came right before graduation of their high school. They kept that high school and schools going. They brought in modular trailers immediately, built on to the existing building that was pretty much damaged. And their school became a focal point for their community and for their community to keep people, because their biggest problem is everybody has scattered to the wind. There were 7 to 10 families with disabilities that were needing services immediately that a Center for Independent Living started to take care of. So what we know a little too, we don't know enough about intermediate and long-term recovery of people with disabilities in this disasters. We are taking the knowledge mining, research, and just plain experience that we've had with recent disasters, and we are bringing those to policy and practices, but we can go further. Another uplifting note, though, I went for 2 hours taking photographs of this community and went and talked to several people and started hearing a similar theme. They're going to start laying my concrete for my foundation tomorrow or next Monday. But like I said, there's very little rebuilding happening in this community right now. I finally got to the hospital, and one of the nurses came out and started chatting with me, and basically what the community had done was an excellent job. They removed most of their rubble, probably 95% of it. They had to break all their concrete foundations because they were no longer stable, and there was only a couple pieces of equipment like that that was available for them. So the city is now ready to rebuild. So had I come 2 weeks later, I would have seen a whole totally different community. We've seen lots of lovely buildings going up and the heart of the city coming back. Anyway, we'll go back to, in summary, additional knowledge mining and creation is also needed when we're talking about research. And from here, I'm going to give it to Glenn to make introductions for our panel.
Back to the model one more time.
Reactor panel. Really, we're looking at a lot of these things. It's important, and I'm sure we could think of other policy practices, procedures, whatever. The notion is that we want to be able to figure out how we can take research and not just let it sit on a shelf, but really be used in a way to help promote change and help us to learn, as Tony talked about earlier from these previous lessons in the past. Tony and I were talking about this chart here, and one of these we thought about is there could be from the policy and practice rectangle way to the right some arrows going back really towards knowledge creation, knowledge mining to help inform what might be next. So I think think of this as kind of an iterative cycle that we can, one informs the other. And what we'd like to do now is this kind of transition. I'm going to, Roberta Carlin's going to do the moderation for this next segment, and I'll have her introduce our special speakers. And I think we're going to vacate here and have the other speakers come up here. So.